Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming.
Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 33. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I am heading all the way down to Essex in the southeast of England to talk to Will Wilson. How are you, Will?
Hello. Hi, Will. Yeah. This is all very grown up. I'm very excited.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. What's with the name, Will? Was it so good they named you twice, or...?
Well, absolutely. My very imaginative parents. I don't think there's anything in it at all, which is a real shame because I'd like to think there's a great story behind it.
I've
just been to a christening in a church actually, and on the wall was the plaque for another Will Wilson.
Oh right.
So I died in 1779. So
oh, Christ.
You know, it's actually a surprisingly common name.
I wondered if you'd got any Welsh blood, because that's quite a common thing in Wales. There's a lot of David Davises knocking around and William Williamses and things like that up here. But
I think there's some Scottish in there. I think Wilson's so common everyone can claim to be Scottish if they got Wilson as a second name. But weirdly enough, my great grandfather is a William Wilson as well. I think it would be stretching the imagination to think that my parents had any sort of genuine interest in copying names or anything.
Okay, so how's
easy to spell?
How's Essex? It's a much maligned or stereotyped part of the UK, isn't it? But now's your chance to set the record straight, because there's some lovely places down there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, why erode the stereotype is great. You know, I'm all for the stereotype. I can vouch for some of them as well. They're very true.
Do you wear a Burberry baseball cap yourself or not?
Of course I do. Absolutely. And I drive a white Range Rover. But, you know, why wouldn't you? When in Rome. No, it's a bit weird because I'm actually a Suffolk boy. And if anyone asks, I say I'm from Suffolk, but I've been adopted by Essex because of my new wife Zoe, yeah, who's downstairs at the moment.
Yeah.
She's from Essex, so she's a proper Essex girl. And actually, I secretly love Essex.
Yeah, okay.
It's got a really nice edge to it, which kind of makes everything a bit more exciting.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
So everyone's pushing to be a bit to do a bit better for themselves and achieve a bit more, and
yeah,
it's actually quite exciting. Yeah, so Essex is Essex has also got an amazing coastline which most people don't know about. So where we are now, I'm half an hour into Liverpool Street on a train and about half an hour drive to some of the nicest coast in the UK.
Yeah, okay, so your family are from Suffolk then?
That's right. Well, Dad's from Suffolk and Mum's from London.
Okay.
And Dad's from a farming sort of background, I suppose, in Suffolk. And Mum's grew up in Wimbledon in London. Just by chance really ended up in agriculture.
Okay.
And ended up meeting my dad. And the rest is sort of history, I suppose.
Yeah, okay.
Wonderful history, of course.
Yeah, absolutely. But so do you didn't grow up on a farm then, or did you?
Oh, I did. Yeah, well, I grew up on... Dad's got a council tenancy.
Okay.
Outside Suffolk.
Okay.
But it's actually on the Suffolk-Essex border, close to East Burgold.
Okay.
It's about 130 acres.
Yeah.
So I got some of the farming, but not a huge amount of it, because 130 acres, you know, there would have been... I think there was about 26 years ago when I was four was when they first moved there. Not in this part of the world, isn't really viable.
Yeah, okay.
So Dad decided that it wasn't going to work. So he went off and got other jobs. My mum worked for the Department of DEFRA.
Okay, yeah.
So she was working in London. And then, yeah, basically, so I got some of the good bits of farming without some of the bad bits, if you know. And I don't really know how I ended up staying farming as a career, but there you go.
So did you, as a little kid running around on the farm, did you want to work in agriculture when you grew up or be a farmer, or were your thoughts just never in that direction?
I don't know. I've never known what I want to do, and I don't think I ever will. I have to sort of come to terms with that eventually. My dad once said that, you know, my dad's 67, and he's sort of saying he doesn't know what to do with what he wants to do with his life yet. Yeah. So, I suppose you start with what your parents do, don't you?
Yeah.
You follow a bit of what they do. You pick up the bits you like, and yeah, you just sort of follow your own sort of path, I suppose.
Okay.
I like farming because throughout say sort of sixth form and university, it was a really good way of making loads of pocket money.
Yeah.
So it's worth sticking with from that point of view, because you could go away, drive tractors for a summer, earn a small fortune.
Yeah.
You know, and it's always been handy from that point of view. So
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, I had model tractors and stuff.
Yeah.
But there was definitely something missing in terms of, I just never really was desperate to become a farmer.
Yeah.
It was always keep your options open, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. So you went to university in Reading. I think you didn't study agriculture there then.
No, this is kind of that not sure about what I'm doing with myself type thing.
Okay.
So I actually studied food marketing and business economics.
Okay.
So you can study agriculture at Reading, and it's got a very good agriculture department.
Uh-huh.
But I ended up studying, it was actually referred to as girl studies because it was nearly all girls on the course, which was, obviously it meant nothing to me at the time.
Absolutely.
But we shared some crossover with the agrics, and we had some really fascinating lectures because it was all basically how to sell Mars bars to customers, how to sell cigarettes without, you know, what are the moral implications of things like selling cigarettes, all these sort of things. And they were very good live lecturers.
Yeah.
So a lot of people who are coming in from outside to do a couple of days lecturing, which is awesome, because then, you know, actually to have someone who works for a cigarette company come and try and explain to you how you can sell cigarettes and then the moral implications are absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, and the same with Mars bars, actually, you know.
Yeah.
You're trying to sell more Mars bars all the time. And what does that mean? And
I would have thought that would actually have been a really interesting degree to do.
It is really interesting.
Yeah.
It had a really nice crossover with agriculture. So it wasn't just like we were, you know, there was a bit of agricultural policy came into it, and we did accounting and all sorts of different bits and pieces.
Mm.
We did a really interesting day at the Majeski Stadium, which is a local football rugby stadium where London Irish are based. Working out, you know, what should we do with that? What would they do with their catering and all this sort of stuff? And just little things like that. And it worked really well. And it was a nice sized course and stuff. So I've got a real soft spot for Reading.
Yeah.
I'm glad I went, because the temptation was to go to, you know, an agricultural university, but I wouldn't quite have got that whole living in the city thing, which was what I was really wanted.
Yeah.
I was kind of at that point, I was ready to not, you know, ready to try it out anyway.
I get that, actually, because I went to Harper Adams, and as much as I loved it, one of my best friends actually went to Reading, and I used to go and see him sometimes, and I see what you mean there. He did get more people from a wider background than I did, I should say.
That's true. But then, having said that, we had all these people there, but we still managed to form pretty strong cliques. So it's not like we were particularly radical in our approach.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed Reading. I can still go back to a couple of the pubs if I'm careful. So that was good. But you said you went to Harper. I mean, I didn't tell you, but I did a postgraduate certificate at Harper. I actually did. Well, it was like a year's course where Harper give you the certificate at the end.
Yeah.
It's like a
remote access type course, and that's part of the MDS training. So so I know Harper really well.
Okay, cool. So when you were at Reading, then did you? I'm going to ask you this, even though you said you're not really sure what you want to do now. Did you develop any ideas about where your future was going to head then when you were there?
No. I still, well, if I don't know now, why would I have known then? Yeah. No, I don't know. To be honest, my parents are amazing people, and they've always just said that you can do whatever you want to do, and to keep your options open. And my dad spent a lot of time traveling when he was in his sort of 20s. Mm-hmm. Literally, you know, he traveled the world. He actually sold a he did the service deals for Massey Ferguson tractors.
Okay.
So if you grow up, so he went, I mean, he was literally all over the Arab countries, all over the world, really. And kind of growing up with him, I suppose the only thing I knew I wanted to do is probably travel as much as I could. I think that's pretty much all I knew about it. And then and then everything else just sort of falls into place, you know. You just sort of, oh, an opportunity comes along, there you go, I'll do that. You know, another thing comes along, you do that. I sound really laid back and cool. I'm not really, but you know, that's the image I'll portray anyway.
Okay. So
do you know what you want to do, Will? Here you go. Here's a good question. Do you know what you want to do?
No, not really. No. I suppose I will. I've got a family farm, and I'm very happy. Very happy there, and I've got four small children, so I would like one or more of them to take on the farm one day. That would be great, but I mean, that's
like a good enough plan. That's more of a plan than I've ever had. So there you go.
Yeah, on your show notes, you said when you talked about university, the information you sent me, you said that you've always had a bit of a love-hate relationship with agriculture. And I was really, really interested in that comment, because I gather that from following you on Twitter, because very often when everyone on Ag Twitter is kicking off about something, say someone writes an article in The Guardian and everyone's up in arms because we're all quite defensive over our industry, probably over defensive.
Yeah.
You will very often put out a comment or a tweet. And very often really makes me think, like, you'll put someone out and you think, do you know what, you're right there. That's that you think about things in maybe a slightly, I guess you've got a foot inside and outside agriculture, so you maybe have a slightly different way of looking at things. Is that fair to say?
I mean, I always, it's the way my brain works as well. You know, I don't really see a black and white. I've never seen a black and white to anything. So there's always a level of gray.
Yeah,
and it's always interesting to see what other people are coming from, because they're not wrong. They just see it from a different angle sometimes. And my love-hate relationship with agriculture is possibly partly to have a chip on my shoulder, because I know I've got peers who have got wonderful family farms they've gone back to, and it's not going to be something I'm going to achieve. So, you know, I think you just got to be honest about that. There is quite a lot of that in agriculture. And then the other thing is, I think, having seen both of it and having traveled quite a lot, you don't really realize how lucky you are till you go and see other people.
Yeah.
And then you go, wow, actually, you've got a lot more than 98% of the rest of the world. Yeah. And you're still finding things to get upset about.
To moan about,
You know. I mean, I do like to... I also like to write something controversial, because you shouldn't be allowed to get away with saying silly things all the time. Not you, Will, but just in general, the industry shouldn't be allowed to. And it should, you know, it should also remember that the people who pay the bills are the people who are buying your product.
So,
no, if they want it, they can have it.
That's true.
And if you don't supply it, someone else will. Yeah. So, that's a salesman in me talking, perhaps. I don't know.
No, you're right. But I do. Enjoy following you on there, because as you say, I think you just have a bit of a different point of view, and I think that's really interesting.
I think maybe that part of it is just not being, I'm not die in the wall agriculture, and I've always just managed to sit on the edge of most things I do, not be particularly committed to anything. which gives you a good overview, but it never makes you very good at anything. It just makes, you know, just makes you quite good, quite average at a lot of things rather than very good at a couple of things. But okay. But it does mean you find the opportunity. You know, yeah. You see the opportunity pop up, and then when someone looks at it as a risk or a challenge rather than an opportunity, it's always a bit like, well, spin it on your head.
Yeah.
And you might have an industry there, you know, that's a whole opportunity. I mean the great thing is this vegan thing.
Yeah.
You know, vegans still eat vegetables.
Yeah.
They could still be a massive, I know, you know, they're not going to do much good for everyone with big chicken sheds and stuff, mm. but it doesn't mean that those of us or those farmers who aren't reliant on animal, you know, don't have animal side to the business.
Yeah.
There's an opportunity there for them. The same with vegetarians. You know, it's yeah. people write these guys off a bit too quick. You know, organic farming. I have quite a lot. Well, I've had a reasonable amount of experience of organic farming, and as much as I thought some of it was not particularly, I don't know, it wasn't quite for my taste. A lot of it was actually quite clever,
yeah.
and it's by writing off a whole thing, you miss out on the little subtle bits where you go, actually, you know, a lot of this is irrelevant, but yeah. there's that 1% which is worth thinking about, and that's, and right. that's kind of where I come from, I suppose. But
yeah, well, there's,
like there, I say, it's,
there's an organic farmer just on that, just down the road from here, a neighbour of ours, who grows some of the best crops of grass you will ever see, and you'd be very foolish to ignore that. But, you know, he's obviously doing something right in his system. I think you're right. You could, yeah, there's opportunities to learn from these people, isn't there?
Yeah, but you've got to be careful with social media because it emphasizes the best and the worst of mm. the people on it. You know, I know for a, you know, I know it makes me look funny sometimes when I'm not really, and it makes me look provocative sometimes when I'm not intending to be. And it's, you know, so yeah. I really enjoy social media. It's good fun. And I get to do great things like this. So it's yeah. definitely worth it.
Okay. So after Reading, then you yep. went to trod the well-traveled path down to Australia for a year.
I did. Yeah. I basically got on the, same plane as everyone else, all the other sort of slightly bored looking farmers, sons and daughters who were like, well, what should we do next? Oh, well, we don't actually want to start our lives yet, so let's go to Australia for a year. You know, where you're like, oh, yeah. I got a student loan bigger than a 5 double-decker buses yeah, stacked on top yeah. of each other.
Yeah.
You know, I really ought to go and get a real job, but I think I can put it off for another year.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So I went to Australia, a bit like most of my life. I had no plans. I rocked up. I had a couple of, really good jobs, opportunities came up, made some money, spent some money, wasted some money, wasted some time, bummed around a bit.
Yeah.
Had some great experiences. Australia is an amazing country,
mm.
but there's definitely, what I like to do if I go traveling is work somewhere,
because
mm-hmm. if you work somewhere, you open up this whole other
yeah.
element to the country. So I've always tried, if I can, to get jobs and get work. And yeah, my God, Australia, it gets exciting when you get into the middle of nowhere and you go and work for a, you know, big family farm out there.
Yeah.
It was really good.
Yeah.
I was quite glad to not spend too much of that time. I think my health was beginning to suffer towards the end. But, you know, you do need to dry up eventually.
Yeah. You but, must have had yeah. fun driving dumper trucks in a lithium mine, though. That must have been awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man, why did I leave that job? It was incredible. I still regret it to this day. No, I got lucky, basically, that I got a job for an employer. Basically, when I arrived in Australia, I found myself some digs in Perth.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure why when I went to Perth in the first place, but I quite like Perth.
Yeah, that's a great system.
And I started just phoning around saying, you know, can you find me some jobs? And I initially thought, oh, great, I'll walk into some mining job, you know, be Rolex watches and champagne, because that's what everyone was doing, you know.
That's right, yeah.
Perth was the loads of money sloshing around. Loads of women
Kalgoorlie,
as well,
because
blokes
were
out high. That's it, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And loads of women, because all the blokes were working on the mines, so you just sort of thought, wow, this is a rock and roll lifestyle I've been looking for. and I talked my way into a combine driving job, which is for the you know, the farming job. which is great fun. You know, basically just driving big combines around fields that you can't really see the edge of. And, you know, try not to catch fire, basically. That was what it came down to. And then I finished that. I came back. I thought that I would buy myself a camper van. So I bought a camper van. I nearly killed myself driving it around because it was a death trap. So I sold it back to the guy. It was awful. Well, honestly, it was so bad.
Was it a VW camper van?
No, it was like a Mitsubishi thing. what were they called? That looks like the parcel vans with the end, you know, where you sit over the front wheel.
I know the ones.
It's got an engine in between the passenger and the driver.
Christ
petrol, and it was just the worst. I think the exhaust literally sort of came out just an inch, you know, above my right eye. Everywhere I drove, it was I felt genuinely ill, and I was ripped off, but I was also a bit of a mug, so I sold it back to the guy. And he was like, why don't you want it? And I just said, look, I want to get rid of it. I can't sell it to anyone else without, you know, having some sleepless nights knowing that they're probably gonna kill themselves in it, so you can have it back. So he took it back off me, minus obviously a bit of losers hating money to make the deal go through. And then I thought, well, that was a bit of a waste of time. I've wasted a bit of money. Better go get a job. So, yeah, basically, I phoned them up again. And I ended up on a lithium mine just outside Esperance, north of Esperance.
Yeah, okay.
Which isn't far from Kalgoorlie around there.
Yeah. Lovely spot.
And
Esperance, gorgeous.
Yeah, it is. It's really nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
What I ended up doing was they were actually building it, so I wasn't on. It's an open cast mine, so basically they scrape the material off the surface, and they were just putting in the grading machinery. So what they do is they take thousands of tons of this stuff, they refine it on site, and then they put it on trains. The trains go to the coast, and it goes to China.
Wow.
So for every 100,000 tons of stuff they were refining, they only got a ton of lithium, which goes into batteries. So it was, the whole thing was bizarre. But I really enjoyed it because you know, they're paying a fortune. You get paid a fortune, you get all your breakfast, dinner, lunch, you get treated like, you know, put up in a hotel. Well, it's not a hotel, but a bit like a hotel. So all you have to do is not go completely crazy.
You must have met some characters though in that job.
Yeah, they're awesome, mate.
I bet they were.
There's a guy called Bimbo. He was cool. they were really nice guys, and there was loads of Irish guys there as well. It was just a really strange mix, but to be fair, it was really good fun.
So after getting back to the UK, what happened then?
Yeah. What did I do? I've always been very good at keeping jobs, so I probably went and found a job somewhere doing something. I think off the top of my head, I think it was Easter, so I was probably de-stoning or something like that. For that time of year. And then, you know, my dad saw an advert in the back of the Farmers Weekly for this course called MDS, which is the Management Development Scheme.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I got that right. Which is 4 6-month placements in agriculture and supply chain. So a little bit high. It's not straight agriculture. It's like Tesco's, Sainsbury's,
mm-hmm.
and then the guys in the middle. So G's, I don't know if you've heard of G's. These are massive companies, but they don't have very big public profiles most of the time.
No.
I went for an interview, which was interesting. And I didn't really think much of it. And then I got lucky, as I always seem to do. And the guy said, can you drive a tractor? Because they were looking for someone specifically to go and grow, work with a potato processing setup.
Okay.
And I said, yes, I can. And I think I must have been the only one in the room at the time. So by default, I was enrolled. And a fortnight later, I was sent to Southold, where there's a company out there who are growing 150 hectares of potatoes, something like that. Or was it 300 hectares? I can't remember now. It was a lot anyway. And I'd already worked for the co-op farms during the summer, so I kind of knew big scale farming. So it was quite exciting. And part of the role of MDS is you're meant to go in, you go in at like a management level, even though you're not really ready to do it. And it's a bit of a baptism of fire. And the other thing is they don't give you much warning about where you go next. So you're kind of expected to suspend real life for a couple of years. So I ended up in Southwold living with a vicar, an ex-army vicar. In a flat in the middle of a place called Wrentham, which is really nice.
Just
got on with it, really. I mean, I was, I went in thinking I was the big, I am super clever, look at me, management, you know, check me out. And basically I realized in the first fortnight that I didn't know anything. I should shut up and listen. I was told that to my face several times, and that's probably the most important thing I've ever learned. So basically sums it up from there. I did that for 6 months. I moved on to a company which imports oranges in Kent. So I did some work with oranges, which is, citrus is interesting, really interesting business.
I got it.
And that was in the run up to Christmas, so that's when it gets really busy. So citrus in Kent, where does it? Oh, that's when I went to Riverford in France. So, you know, Riverford, the organic company.
Yeah.
You know, I said I'd done some work with organic.
Yeah.
They sent me out to France to manage a harvest out there. With their teams out there, and it was a fascinating experience.
I'll
the French of French agriculture is different. Well,
different how dare I ask?
The French lifestyle is different in that you know, everything is very much centered around the employee rather than the employer. So you know, we knew how to have good lunches, and we knew not to take life too seriously. But the actual, it's a little bit different to say the UK, where you can find and hire and fire casual staff very easily in the UK. You know, if you want graders or people to work in picking or whatever, you just say, I need this many people on Tuesday. Whereas in France, you've got to be a bit more tactical about it. There isn't quite the flexibility in the workforce. So managing the workforce is a bit trickier. There was a bit of sort of, the farm had a bit of a colourful history, so I think it's probably the best way to put it. And there were a few relationship challenges, but that was all part, that's part of it, you see, that's part of the MDS thing, is you're not really meant to go there and enjoy it, you're meant to go there and learn. But I do, I've got a real soft spot for France, having spent some time there, and you sort of go, actually, the place is a place called Chalon, which is just on the near Nantes, N-A-N-T-E-S. And it's not like necessarily the bit you rush to, but those are normally the best bits of countries, the bits where you want to go, but the bits where you end up. So I had a lovely time there. I really enjoyed it. I came back to Devon for a couple of months, working with Riverford in Devon. And where did I finish? Oh, I finished up at a place called Worldwide Fruit in Spalding. So there you go. That's me. That's my whole 2 years.
So that's a tremendous range of experience then, isn't there? I mean, you know, I guess
it
is,
really.
Of roles and all kinds of people, and you know, you must, I mean, that's a hell of an opportunity to learn an awful lot in a very short time, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I would suggest to anyone who is even questioning what to do with themselves to at least look at the website and then decide if you want to apply. But I mean, my attitude's always been apply for everything and expect nothing and then be excited if it happens. So like MDS I'll put it this way, it's tough because you give up quite a lot to do it. So it's not something, if you're not gonna enjoy it, or if you're not gonna get, if you're, you know, if you're not going to put everything into it, possibly not the best thing for you. Because, you know, they expect you for 2 years to go away and basically suspend, you know, what you were doing at the time to go and do this 2 year course. Which is good. And it's, you know, it's a good thing to do when you're young. You know, but so basically, the whole point of MDS is that I then go off and find a career in agricultural food and supply chain management. And they're very good because they even pay you on the way through. So it works out lots of good ways, really. And that's where I got my that's where I worked at Harper, or where I got my certificate from Harper, my postgraduate certificate in food and supply chain management. There you go.
Okay, so
sounds very fancy.
You were doing that at the same time, or did you do?
You sort of do it as part of the course.
Yeah, right. I see.
Okay. Yeah, you do the exercises that you get sent for, and you do lots of management training throughout. Actually, talking about it, I was incredibly lucky. I always have been lucky, but this is another example of where, you know, someone has obviously seen something in me and decided that I should to give me a shot. And, you know, that's you know, that's how it goes, isn't it, I suppose?
Okay, so
yeah, seriously.
Did you then take your qualifications and experience and go in that direction, or did you go in another way?
Well, you know the answer to this.
Don't let people behind the curtain. don't give away my professional secrets.
Yes, well, I took all this, and I'm now I've gone and made a six-figure salary and a senior manager in a large supermarket. No, I didn't do that at all. No, I mean, without going into too much detail, the MDS really took it out of me. One specific placement didn't work out very well, which put a bit of it tainted it a little bit for me.
Yeah.
So actually I sort of thought I want to go and take some time out. A lot of my friends had gone into London to do great things with property and law and stuff like that. You know, thing where it's so amazing they have to tell you about it all the time, and you start to wonder if it's that good. If it's that good, why do you have to keep telling me about it? But I fell for it, and I went looking for a job in London, and the opportunity at Farmers Weekly came up, and I applied based on my principle of apply for everything, expect nothing, and be excited when it happens. I was very, very lucky to be offered a job. So I worked in London at the Farmers Weekly offices, which is in Sutton. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know London very well.
Vaguely. I've got family and friends who work in London. I know where it is. Yeah, vaguely now.
Yeah, so southwest London area.
Nice
I worked place. In that's it. Yeah. Well, Sutton's not so good, but it's not far from Wimbledon. Wimbledon's quite smart. So I got a spare room in Wimbledon. I really enjoyed my time there. I just wasn't the right fit. I'm not the right person to write technical articles because I was on the arable desk.
Okay.
So as much as I enjoyed it, I think it was fairly apparent after about, say, 9 months that the fit wasn't quite right.
Okay.
So I loved every bit of it apart from the actual important bit, which is being able to write, detailed technical copy under pressure.
Okay.
So, I'm a great journalist apart from the bits where you have to write stuff. So, I really enjoyed it, loved it. I was living in Wimbledon, which was great fun because, you don't realise how much fun it is to live somewhere like London until you realise there's 7 pubs on your way home.
Yeah.
And there's 3 of you all heading in the same direction, and that can happen like on a Monday night, and you just think this is amazing. I used to plan for months to be able to do this. But, so really enjoyed it. Met some great people, and still, best friends with all of them. Really, it was a fantastic experience, and I'd recommend it to anyone. Go and just go and if a Farmers Weekly ever advertise for anything, apply for it because it's great fun. And I probably ought to mention that I met my now wife Zoe while I was in Kent. So I had other interests, I suppose, outside of working. Basically what happened was she's a super duper equine vet. She really is incredibly clever and works very hard. So she must be short-sighted though, because she decided to marry me. But
has she talked you into getting involved with the horses, or do you stay away?
Don't go there. Well, there's some things we don't talk about. We don't talk about horses, and we don't talk about the cost of surgery on pet dogs that are perpetually ill, because some things are just not. Some boxes are best worth just not opening. So, I'm not a horsey. I'm not into horses. Okay. I tolerate horses. Okay. Do you like horses?
My daughters have started pestering for one. So,
oh my god, it's a nightmare,
and it's getting more persistent. And I've resisted.
I think it's a bit like owning a fish and chip shop. You don't want to eat fish and chips.
Yeah.
So luckily Zoe likes horses. She's got two small horses. Okay. I mean, really small, like waist height, miniature Shetland pony. No, I've probably got that wrong. Yeah, no, not there's some sort of pony type
okay.
thing, which I actually quite enjoy. But yeah, we don't have any big horses. And I think the other thing that terrifies me is the number of injuries that people get from horses. And you know, everyone seems to go, "Oh, it doesn't matter. It's only a horse," you know. And you sort of go, "If it was a motorbike, everyone would be like, you're so stupid. Who would be stupid enough to fall off a motorbike and hurt themselves? Yet if you fall off a horse, everyone's like, oh, you know, never mind. It's only a horse. Yeah. He didn't know what he was doing."
Yeah.
So, yeah, the thought of Zoe riding around on a horse, falling off and breaking her back or something just terrifies me. So, yeah, we have the deal is if she buys a horse, I buy a motorbike.
That's the deal. Okay. Yeah,
right. That sounds, yeah, that so sounds there you go. Sensible. Maybe you should do some sort of deal with your girls, Will. You know, come up with some sort of similar reciprocal agreement.
Well, at this age, they'd love it if I bought a motorbike.
Oh, that's yeah.
I'll have to think of something better than that. But,
yeah, okay. you'll have to think of some way of. I don't know, scaring them witless of horses. I think that'd be a good start. Like,
yeah, well, you know. I'm doing my best.
Yeah. Yeah. Dress up as a horse and like jump in on them at night and be actually terrified and never see them again. There you go.
That's not a bad idea. Okay, so you met Zoe, and then Zoe is from Essex, and that's how you ended up in
Essex.
Yeah,
that's right. She's actually very local to where we live now in Hatfield Temple. So, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, basically it all came together at the same time. I left London, she left Hertfordshire, where she was working with the RVC, Royal Veterinary College.
Yeah, okay.
We ended up back in Hatfield Peveril. What did I do? Oh, well, she found a job locally with a local vet practice, which she loves, which has worked out really well. And me being sort of the forever wanderer, not really knowing where I wanted to do or what I wanted to do, I got a job... I got a job fixing windows in a housing estate in Watford. So I did that for a couple of months.
Okay.
So I'm pretty good at double glazing. I can tell you anything about different double glazing systems. No, I was the gopher. I had to go and pick up windows from a manufacturer and drive them into Watford on the big council house housing estate where they were changing them over. So, you know, I'm not one for sitting still.
Yeah. Well, I mean, jumping out is that you don't find it hard to get jobs, do you? And I know you said you've had some luck and you're lucky, but, you know, you kind of make your own luck a bit. I mean, you must have a pretty strong work ethic.
I think my mum described it as a Protestant guilt or something like that, which is where you can't possibly spend any money and you must always be earning money.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thought of not earning money is just, oh God, can you imagine?
Yeah.
You know? So I've always found jobs. And I've always got lucky. And I think 10% of that is I've always tried and worked quite hard at it. And 90% is, I literally, you know, it's just people giving me a shot. So, yeah. But I think it's true when someone says the harder you work, the luckier you get.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But I've also done some terrible jobs as well. So it all goes round and round in circles. So, so Zoe found a job. And then it just happened that the local concrete manufacturer here were looking for someone to work with this concrete panel system for a silage clamp. It was a very early days in the business, and I'm not entirely sure, really understood what silage was, but they knew that there was an opportunity to build them for anaerobic digestion plants.
Mm-hmm.
So basically I went for an interview, and again, I got a bit lucky, and I joined the company about 4 or 5 years ago as their first employee. Basically, it's grown from there.
So you were literally their first employee, first person they employed.
Yeah, well, there was a guy who did a sort of a third of a part of a job before that. It was all treated as part of the concrete company. And then they sort of said, oh, we can split this off, make it into a different business, might have some legs. Perhaps it was a bit of a punt, I think, perhaps at the beginning, perhaps more than I realised. But the AD industry has been really good, basically, on the silage clamp front. And I've carved myself out a bit of a niche, which is easy to do when it's such an obscure industry like silage clamps. So there's another tip of the tip from the top is if you want to be good at something, choose something no one else is interested in, because then you don't have much competition. So basically we've the business is like, you know, the business we started off with 4 or 5 clamps. We're now on to about 45.
Is that all renewable energy plants, or is that with silage clamps as well?
It's about by sort of number, by individual size, it's about 80-20.
Okay.
But if you were to go by like volume, it's more like sort of 95-5. So 95% is renewable energy, 5% is like dairy and livestock.
Okay.
And I mean, we've built some amazing structures and huge plants. Really, really interesting. The AD sector is like the whole life cycle of an industry in a in 3 or 4 years we've gone boom. I don't know, I wouldn't say bust, that's very negative, but we've gone boom. And you see some real characters, you know, high risk industry brings out some really interesting people from all different backgrounds. I really enjoyed it actually.
I had a look on the website. It's the company, it's bock.uk.com.
Buy your silage clamps today.
I'll invoice you for that shout out later. But there's on the website, there is there's a really cool video, isn't there? And it's very interesting. Obviously it's interesting me as a livestock farmer, but I think it'd be quite interesting for anyone just seeing how it works. And it's pretty cool.
I think what I like is that it's a really simple idea, and actually sometimes we get too carried away looking for complicated solutions to really simple problems. I think I've got a bit of a beer in my bodies at the moment about data, about ag tech and data and stuff.
Yeah.
Where everyone's getting excited about being able to monitor, you know, how often your cow sneezes and stuff. And the more I see of the farms I go and work on, I think actually that data would be great. But there's some more important things that people need to just understand perhaps and work a little bit harder on before they're worrying about, you know, really obscure technical details.
I know what you mean.
Everyone's different though, so that's not fair. You know, there's some people who get really into it, but, I'm always looking for the, I suppose it's partly because I'm lazy as well, so maybe looking for the easy answer, you know. What's the easiest way of doing this? Get someone else to do it normally.
From a silage clamp point of view, and from a farming point of view, why are bock clamps different? Why are they? What makes them stand out?
Do you know what basically it's a sloping wall rather than a vertical wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I thought it would be forever. You know, in terms of, I thought that's all people wanted to know. But actually, the difference is we actually know what we talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a little bit of I think that's it, really. We just know we actually genuinely want to get it right.
Yeah.
Which separates us, I suppose, from some other companies where they'll sell you whatever you ask for.
Yeah.
We tend to say, well, that's nonsense. We're not going to do that. We don't really want you to do that. We don't think that's a good idea. You know, and I've seen all the pressures, you know, I know why people just sell stuff. Because some people, that's what they need to do. You know, some companies work on the basis of an enormous turnover and a tiny margin, and you know, it's all about the sales and stuff. So I guess the major difference is the actual design, the experience we've had from the past and our German colleagues, and our genuine genuine interest in doing the job as right as we can.
Okay.
And helping people get it right. That sounds really cheesy, but it's true.
No, it doesn't at all. But I mean, one question that I've got is, why do you use asphalt base rather than a concrete base?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like the number one, because we do a lot of work with existing clamps, rather than necessarily trying to build new ones, we have to work with existing clamps. Some of them are very new and they don't work. The biggest problem with concrete is that it has expansion joints in it.
Yeah.
So if you think of your concrete slab, it's got expansion and contraction joints. Well, expansion joints, aren't they? And they're always, nearly always, the lowest point in the clamp.
Yeah.
So that's where the leachate sits. And then if nearly all the clamps we go and see, the biggest problem is that they leak. And the biggest cause of the leaks is the expansion joints in the concrete. And so in the past, that was fine because you just accepted it and it leaked and that was, you couldn't do anything about it and whatever, you know, it's only a silage clamp, doesn't matter. There were plenty of other things that were going wrong, so silage clamps were hardly on the radar. But what's happened is everything's got bigger, silage clamps have got fuller, tractors have got bigger. The old clamps are starting to leak, the walls are moving, they're getting unsafe, and yeah, basically people are wanting to look at other things. I mean, it's even really silly things like with an asphalt base, you can slope it into the middle. So at the moment, most clamps have a flat fall. If you imagine your clamp, I mean, I might be wrong here, but it normally have a fall from front to back.
Yes.
Like a flat fall. And then the leachate just wanders all the way around, all the way from the front to the back. It doesn't sort of follow a path. It just sort of tends to sort of wash around all over the place. Whereas with asphalt, you can have a fall from the two sides into the middle, and then the leachate follows one path straight down the middle of the clamp.
Yeah,
and you can go then that way, you can go into one drain. And you can't do that quite so easy with concrete.
No.
And then, I mean, I'm not in the silage clamp asphalt business, but it is the way forward, I think.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, they've been doing it in Germany for yonks, but they've had a lot more money, I think. They're much more willing to invest in silage clamps. I don't know if there's maybe a bit more tax, a few more tax sort of benefits, perhaps, that sort of thing. So yeah, basically there's loads of opportunities with silage clamps, and it's quite nice to have a little niche and to genuinely make a difference. So yeah, that's good enough for me.
Do you think that farmers over here are generally paying increased attention to silage quality and the benefits that it can bring? I think they are. I think that
the problem is historically with silage clamps is that they're just so far wrong from, not wrong, that's not the right word, but from what they're if you look at your farm, nearly everything else would have been upgraded from when your dad was in, you know, your previous generations are there, but the silage clamps don't tend to have been.
No.
You know, the tractors have all doubled in size, but the clamps are still the same clamps that was, you know, were put in. I mean, this is very general, but this has been my experience. You know, the good chance the only thing older than the silage clamp on most farms is a dinner jacket. You know, it's that sort of, you know. And, well, maybe you can still fit into your dinner jacket from your first ball, but my dinner jacket is it certainly doesn't do up anymore. So there you go. That's a very poor analogy, I suppose. But
no, I know what you're saying.
I can still get it on if I breathe in, you know, just got to
Okay. All right, well, that's a joke.
Yeah, so I, you know,
go on.
I was gonna say silage clamps are interesting. I mean, they're not I suppose if you change enough things it'll start to make an impact, and hopefully people will come to me and ask me questions so that they can take some of the advice. And actually, I don't care if they buy anything or not, because there's just some small things that make such a big difference to what you end up doing.
Yeah.
So yeah, there you go. That's why I enjoy it, because you can help people.
Well, generally in your experience, what's it like trying to sell to farmers then? How's that?
It's okay, actually. It's weird. Yeah, it's, well, the first thing is you've got to remember is that you're normally in their house. You know, it's not like turning up to someone's office where you sit down in the reception and then, you know, they offer you a cup of coffee. You normally rock up at their house. You normally spend 10 minutes wandering around, wondering where they are. And then you'll rock up and then you'll go and have a cup of coffee. And actually, I do enjoy it.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong. I enjoy it, and I enjoy meeting. I mean, you normally meet some of the extended families you go on, and it's really nice. I don't think selling to farmers is different to selling to anyone else. Everyone's human. The only difference is it's a bit more personal with a farmer. It's easy to spend someone else's money. It's a bit harder to spend your own.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, what selling is very similar across the world. It's just, again, it's just hard work and luck.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You know, you get lucky, you work a bit harder, you get a bit luckier.
Yeah, okay.
And I think sales in general gets a bad, I mean, I'm not, I like to think of a bit more than a salesman, but it's such an important part of our business that if you pretend you're not, then, you know, it's so important to so many businesses, though. This is perhaps where farming sometimes falls down. You know, the world stops turning if people stop selling stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it happens all the time. And sales in farming has a very, it's not a bad reputation, but people get a bit snooty, don't they? Mm. I don't know, you know, if you think, you know, God, these salesmen, everyone in farming immediately thinks of, like, Walker off Dad's Army, which is an image I can roll with that, you know. but actually, it's a really important job, although it doesn't, you know, it might not always feel like it, because it makes you think about different things, and they have, you know, for a salesman come onto your farm, 90% of the time they're really well-meaning and they want to help you do something better. You do get the 10% who are desperate to make a sale, but you know who they are probably in about the first 5 minutes. So yeah, I do enjoy it, and I enjoy the chance to get around and see people, and I enjoy making a difference and stuff. But I do wish agriculture would embrace sales, not salesmen, but embrace the concept of sales and the concept of doing what your customer wants.
That's right.
And you know, adding a margin and making yourself some money rather than just growing something and then being surprised when they can't sell it. You know, but you do it all the time as well with sales. It's fascinating. If you ever go for a job interview, all you're doing is selling yourself. You know, if you meet new people, that's what you're doing, is selling yourself. You don't even realize you're doing it. Your whole, you know, most of your life is revolving around selling something. You know, it's really interesting. You know, it's really interesting. It's good fun, and I enjoy it. And I've been very lucky. I've met some really wonderful farmers, and I've met some really horrible people. But actually, I enjoy the horrible people as much as I enjoy the wonderful people, because everyone's different. So you know, it all goes around in a big circle.
So if anyone's listening and they want to get in touch with you, they want some more information, where can they?
Yep.
When's the best place to get hold of you?
Probably best thing to do is find the website for BOCK, which is www.bock-uk.com, and then on the contacts page, all our details are on there.
Okay.
Rather than go through, and then I'm on Twitter, and I can't even remember that now. Oh yeah, @WillWilson100. And I'll be delighted. I'm always happy to answer questions if I can help out, and I've always got something. I've always got about 5 or 6 different random projects on the go, and I'm always happy, you know, really fascinated to hear how other people are doing things as well. So get in touch. It'd be amazing to catch up with people.
So you've mentioned social media there, and I'll jump into that with a smooth segue because I'm so professional. But you do, I can
hear the sliding noise.
Yeah, big clunk. But you've done a lot on social media, and you've done quite a lot. And I'm going to use this sort of analogy here. There's always people in a community or something that organise things and get a lot of people involved. And it's always the same people every time. And then most of the rest of us are pretty useless. But you very much one of those people. So you've always sort of come up with funny hashtags, things like that. So the Average Farmer Awards springs to mind, which was hilarious, and it went on and on, didn't it? That really made a lot of people laugh.
That was my favourite. That was my favourite by a long shot.
It was great. It was brilliant, isn't it? Definitely one of the best things that has been on Twitter, I think. But and then you've done things like organised the Ag Grand National. Well, you draw names and people get a horse in the Grand National and things like that. And it is a community on there, really, isn't it? The ag sort of Twitter community, and as silly as it can get at times, I think we've all benefited from it in a positive way.
Absolutely.
I mean, you've done, and then you've also, I know you've hosted Agri Chat sometimes, which is the weekly chat on Thursday nights, and you did the Felfies, so farm selfies, which was huge, wasn't it? at the time. So
I got lucky again. That wasn't me. I can't take any credit for that. I was just the one who picked it up and ran with it. But yeah, it's yeah. I mean, I don't know, why do I do it? Because it's funny.
Yeah.
And actually, it's absurd. I love the absurd. Yeah. Honestly, it's brilliant, isn't it? And I tell you what, I was looking at the Country File hashtag this afternoon.
Okay.
While it was on,
I dread to think.
And it is just the best, and I love it, and that's basically why I do these sort of things, is because I just think the life can be hard work, and it can all be a bit exhausting, and then you go and see these ridiculous, hilarious things that people write, and you just go, oh, I get it now. This is so much better than real world.
Yeah.
I'll try and remember. Oh, I'll remember my favourite one, this Country File, in a minute. But yeah, so why do I? I do. I enjoy doing hashtags and stuff like that. Yeah. The Grand National. I like horse racing, so the Ag National was an easy one for me.
Yeah.
And yeah, the Felfies was really, that was someone else's idea. Well, it's a group idea, I suppose, and then I just ran with it. And yeah, Average Farm Awards is brilliant. That picture, I can't remember it. Can you remember who it was now? The guy who was asleep on the bale with his feet up on the sheep fence. Oh, that was such a good picture.
That. Yeah, I can't remember who it was.
That was not the best picture ever. It was like, I want to get it painted in like a giant mural and just hung off the wall.
Yeah.
Like the picture of serenity. So yeah, I mean, I just enjoy it. Yeah. I like organizing people. And again, I do believe that the more you put in, the more you get out.
Yeah.
You must find the same with the podcast, eh? The more you put in, the more you get, the more benefit you get from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I keep finding more and more interesting people to speak to as well. You know, I'm amazed at how many people. I've got a very long list now of people I want to interview, and it's it's amazing, really. How many people?
I'll be the queen soon. Yeah. And who would be, if you could have anyone in the whole world, who would it be alive at the moment? Who would you get?
Oh, anyone in the world?
Tough question.
Yeah. Blimey, you put me. Who's interviewing who here? You put me on the spot.
No. It's because I'm just interested. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
No, I would. I'd be interested to speak to Barack Obama. I think I might be.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
That might be a boring answer, but I'd be very interested to talk to him. I think that would be quite cool.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, I've got I'm a well-connected man. We'll see what I can do with the former leader of the free world. No,
yeah.
Wouldn't I think Trump would be amazing? Actually, I think Donald Trump would be fascinating.
On another way, I suppose he would. I'm not sure we'd get on, but yes, I know what you're saying. I think he would be interesting.
Yeah. I do. I mean, that's the other little thing that I find fascinating at the moment. As I get a bit older and you start to look at life a bit differently, is people who have taken the lead, which is my new thing, you know, where people actually stick your head out above the parapet and go and have a punch at something and kind of, you're going to get shot at, but actually just, that's all part of the fun.
Yeah.
You've got to treat it like that, you know, where you go, actually, I don't care what you people think. I'm going to have a go at this. And half of you might think I'm an idiot, which is fine. The other half of you might hate me, which is fine. But, this is what I find fascinating about. I'm reading books about, you know, famous leaders and stuff. And the amount of their skins must be so thick.
Yeah.
You know, to roll with it.
So, yeah.
So when I take over the world in the future, on the back of this podcast, we'll sort out that Obama can come and spend it with you.
Okay. So what about interagric.com then, Will? Can you tell us about that?
Very early days. I set up a website called theyoungfarmersforum.com.co.uk, which I had really high hopes for. And I did it off the back of, I did a course called the Challenge of Rural Leadership course.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another one of those things that everyone has to apply for. Just go for it. You know, you've got nothing to lose. Go for it. Seriously, came out of that like ready to change the world. I'm going to do it. And actually, I bottled it, which is a shame because I wish now if I just kept hung on to it, hung on to that sort of inspired moment I had afterwards, I really could have done something. But reality sometimes kicks in and you go, well, you do need to make some money, and you know, actually there are other things in life that are perhaps a bit more important.
Mm-hmm.
I set up his website. I thought I was going to change the world. Didn't quite work out for me. I probably didn't put enough time into it. And I think what I realized was I wasn't enjoying it enough. And as soon as you stop enjoying something, you have to be so single-minded, which I'm not, to be able to make it work. So I sort of parked that, and then I said, well, let's just do something you really enjoy. And I've only just got it working. It's very early days, but it's basically a global farming forum. Oh, God, it sounds so pretentious. But with an angle for the slightly more unusual story. So it's not, I don't really want too much opinion. I don't really want too many people having a go at each other because they don't like what they do or whatever, because there's plenty of other places to be.
I was just going to say, there's enough of those already, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you know, who cares? How boring is that? You know? But what I am really interested in is the really obscure stories that crop up every now and again. And you go, actually, that sounds stupid, but it's game-changing. And you'll be amazed at the way you can search the internet now to find these stories pop up. So basically, I'm going to populate it with all the slightly odd, slightly unusual, and not stupid, but the interesting stories are happening to the rest of the world that British agriculture just doesn't even seem to knowledge exists sometimes. So the Chinese, what the Chinese are doing in agriculture at the moment is phenomenal. It's almost beyond understanding, and I think it's not a bad thing just to have an eye on it, just to say, you know, this is what's happening over there, and isn't that amazing, you know, because again, there'll be opportunities come up. The Chinese are buying swathes of Australia, you know, and for the sort of money that you just wouldn't, you know, it's almost unimaginable. So, so basically I'm picking up those sort of stories, dropping them on the website, seeing if anyone's interested. And actually, because I enjoy doing it myself, I don't mind too much if they're not. But I do think that people are interested in what other people are interested in. So maybe people will drop it and have a look. Nothing more to it really. Well, it's, you know, just a bit of fun.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds great. Looking forward to it. Okay.
Yeah, this time next year, Rodney.
Okay. So a couple more things I want to ask you about. Now, you obviously sent me some info beforehand, and you sent me quite a lot of stuff, more than most guests do. And I messaged you back, and this instantly jumped out at me. And you know what I'm going to ask you? You nearly joined the Cirque du Soleil, and I'm fascinated by that, because I can't wait to find out the circumstances of this.
It's a deadly true story. I went traveling in America, to Boston on a. I think I had three or four weeks after a harvest.
Okay.
Sometime, and I went and stayed in a youth hostel, and I was bumming around, not really up to much. I bumped into some strange guy with a vintage Harley Davidson on a museum tour. It gets better. And we rubbed along together. He was like 60 and I was 19 or 20. So it's already, looking back, I'm already going, okay, this is a bit weird. But you know, when you're traveling and you don't care. Yeah. Anyway, we were walking across a bridge one day and this girl just comes up to him and starts talking to him. And I was like, oh, okay. It turns out she actually described herself as an ex-lover of his.
Right.
And she was the stage manager for the Cirque du Soleil. So she was like, oh, you guys better come and watch. And I was like, I don't know what the Cirque du Soleil is, but why not? Let's go for it. So we actually went two nights in a row. I was just the third, the weird hanger-oner at that point, I suppose. But I didn't care about that sort of thing. And so we got backstage passes to the Cirque du Soleil in Boston. I sat on a sofa with all the acrobats dancing around, and then we spent an evening watching the show. And then she said, oh, you know, we're looking for stagehands how long have you got left in America? And I was like, by that point, I think my sort of, you know, my embarrassment factor had kicked in. I was like, I don't want to spend any more time with any of you people. They were really nice, but it was starting to get really odd.
Yeah.
It was a trip. Actually, the whole trip was really odd. I managed to book a youth hostel in the red light. Well, it wasn't. It was the gay district of Washington DC without knowing it.
Okay.
So a couple of the most. So that was like 4 days before. So I was in Washington, and I went. I was in a bar, and I was going, everyone here is really friendly. And people were buying me drinks, and I was like, this America is amazing. And it was only when I got back to the hostel that the guy was like, oh my God, you didn't go down there, did you? I was like, yeah, it was amazing. Everyone kept buying me drinks. And he was like, yeah, you said it's safe, but, you know, just so you know. I was like, oh, okay. And it'd been a whole trip based around those sort of events. So, yeah. So basically she said, oh, yeah, it's all right. We'll find you. You find your accommodation. You follow us around. We need someone to do, you know, like backstage work. And apparently they pick people up and drop people off quite frequently.
Okay.
As they go. And I think she thought I was on like a gap year, or I was like a freewheeling hippie or something. And I said, oh, I'd love to, but, you know, I looked at my imaginary watch and ran out.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, but yeah, the awesome. Circus of Vegas, that is a bizarre place.
I'll bet it is.
Have you ever seen it on TV or anything?
I haven't. No, some friends of mine went fairly recently, and they highly recommended it.
It's fascinating to watch the show. Mm. It's weird to watch the other side when they're behind the scenes.
Because
it's like the normal world, but they're all in character.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then occasionally one of them like swears and starts yelling at the other one in Turkish or whatever language they were speaking to each other.
Yeah,
and you sort of go, okay, this is kind of awesome, but this is all getting a bit weird. So
And
traveling kids, join the circus.
And the other thing is, because I debated whether to ask you about this, but I can't not. When you were 17, you spent the evening.
Beautiful.
Spent the evening in a hotel with the models from the Sunseeker super yachts at the Southampton boat show.
Can you imagine?
How did that happen? And B, should I ask you about this or not?
Can you imagine anything more amazing in your life for a 17-year-old?
No.
You know what I did? I got there. So long story short, I had a summer job, as I always have had jobs doing something somewhere to somewhere. Cleaning speedboats for a guy in Ipswich who was importing speedboats, and he had a stand at the Southampton boat show. He said, can you come and, you know, clean the speedboats on the stand and paint the stand and stuff? And I said, yeah. It was a bit, they were lovely guys, but it was a little bit flying on the seat of your pants type operation. Uh-huh. So I drove the van down, and then I think it was too late for me to drive back, or I'd had enough by that point because I was doing pretty much all the shitty jobs. And he said, oh, well, don't worry, you can have a hotel room. So we went up to the hotel room. And I was walking past all these glamorous girls looking, you know, covered in paint and stuff, thinking like a tramp. And I think it must be about 8 o'clock. And I was just like, all I remember doing is ordering room service and going to bed. And then I woke up in the morning and I was like, what? And I came out and I said, why are there so many beautiful girls? Like, what's going on? What are the supermodels about? And he goes, oh, that's the hotel room for the models for the Sunseeker. And Sunseeker are the super, super yachts. You know, they're the
Abramovich-style
yachts.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's just that thing where you go afterwards, you go, never again, you'll never get that opportunity again. We'll even talk to one of these people. And all you're worried about was, like, getting onion rings on room service. That pretty much sums up my life, to be honest.
That's a very 17-year-old man thing to have. Well, 17-year-old boy thing to have, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what to say to them anyway.
Yeah, I mean,
exactly.
I wouldn't.
Exactly.
Just stand there and sort of slowly dribbling out of the side of my mouth.
Absolutely.
And sort of, you know, I don't think that was going to get me very far. But yeah, now, I mean, imagine, Will.
Goodness me.
It was something else. Okay. Yeah, so I've got myself into some pretty weird situations. But,
Right. Okay. We're gonna wrap this up with the quiz that we do every week. So if you're ready, five quick questions. You ready? What's your all-time favourite song?
My favourite song ever is there's one called Poppy Holler by Chicane.
Oh, I've never heard of that.
Oh, it's good. It's really good. It's like 90s.
How do I not know that if that's 90s?
Electronic. It's called Poppy Hot Pop. Let me just...
Chicane, I'm writing it down.
You'll like it. You'll recognise it as well because they use it on like inspirational TV advert.
Okay.
So that's probably one of my favourite songs.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'll YouTube it after. Okay. We finish this interview. You check your lottery numbers and you find that you've won 10 million quid. What's the first thing you're doing? What's the first thing you're doing?
Oh, you know what? I think about this all the time, and I've never had a good enough answer. You tell you what, this is going to sound bizarre. I have promised myself that if I ever won the lottery, I'd never tell anyone.
Yeah.
not because I want to go and spend it, but just because I don't actually think I have a good enough use for 10 million that wouldn't ruin everything.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
That sounds like a really grown-up thing to say, and I'm not a grown-up at all. But,
I know exactly what you mean.
You know, if someone just gave me 10 million, I think I'd probably rather hide it somewhere or... I'd have to manufacture some way of being able to spend it without everyone knowing I had it in the first place.
Yeah.
Nice car, obviously. What else would I do? Holiday.
Yeah.
It would just be never ending, wouldn't it? Yeah. I'll probably end up killing myself, but you know, what way to go.
Okay. What would your autobiography be called?
That's a really good question. Probably just
I've got a suggestion. It's got to be where there's a will, there's a way, isn't it?
Well, there you go. Yeah, but that's going to be yours, though, Will.
you're the one with the two wheels. So I've only got one.
Okay. I'd probably call it something. I'd probably call it something completely opposite to what it's about, so that people buying it really get like buy it and think, oh. That was disappointing. I call it like how to lose weight in 10 easy steps or something, or how to play the bassoon.
Okay.
I just like to picture people picking it up and then being disappointed.
Okay.
This isn't anything about bassoons. There you go.
All right. If you could trade places with someone for 24 hours only, who would it be and why?
Yeah. It's just controversial because some people don't like it, but I think I'd like to have a go at Jeremy Clarkson for 24 hours.
Oh, okay.
Okay. You know, he's got some. He's not daft, I don't think.
No.
But you just imagine you got the cars. You're probably going to be abroad somewhere anyway.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind a crack at Jeremy Clarkson for 24 hours, to see the job.
Yeah,
you know, I know what's going on behind the scenes. That sounds really unimaginative.
No, I think that'd be a lot of fun.
That would be fun, wouldn't it? That's it. That's fun. As long as it's nothing else but fun.
So I'll probably
stick with that. Yeah.
Okay. And lastly, if you had to recommend a farmer or someone involved in agriculture to follow on social media to a non-farmer, who would it be and why?
Oh, that's a tricky one, eh? I really like Sam Pearson because he's quite passionate about what he does.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, what's the word? It's the Pearson University, isn't it? It's the University of Sam Pearson.
Yeah,
you know, we all learn something from Sam Pearson.
Yeah. Well, it's been great. I said to you before, I think you were one of the first people I followed in ag social media, so which is Christ 5-6 years ago. So it's been fantastic to actually talk to you for so long. It's been brilliant.
Brilliant. Well, honestly, it's a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. I mean, who doesn't like talking about themselves for an hour and a bit.
Yeah.
And if you want a silage clamp, you know.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, well, anyone listening, do follow Will on Twitter at Will. At Will Wilson 100, because like I say, you think about things a little bit differently to some of the rest of us, and I think that's always very interesting. So.
Cool.
Okay. Well, Ben.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure. Good. Yeah, absolutely, mate. I've really enjoyed it.
Good. And best of luck. Best of luck for the future, and hopefully we'll catch up in person soon.
Oh yeah, too right. We need to have a few beers. I think that's the next stop.
That sounds great. All right, to everyone at home, thanks for listening and for the ongoing support and nice comments. Hugely appreciated as always. You can find the podcast from my Twitter page at Will Penry Evans, or search at Rock and Roll Farming on Facebook, Stitcher app, iTunes, Apple Podcasts. If you've got a minute, you enjoying these, please could you leave me a nice review on iTunes with 5 stars to help grow the podcast, because that's a really big help. And thanks to everyone who's done that. Thanks again. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.
Amazing. I mean, Twitter's exactly the same. Yeah. Where you sort of think, blimey, there's people on here who I get on really well with, and I never met them face to face.
Yeah.
And you're perpetually worried that you're going to disappoint them if you ever do meet them. They're like, oh, you're fatter in real life. And I'm like, yep.
Well, I get you shorter in real life. I don't know what it says to me, but...
Really?
Yeah.